are you, Gary?
Yep, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. How you doing?
Not too bad. Well, it's an honor here. I'm in Civil Revolt webzine.
Uh-huh.
And today we're speaking with the legendary Gary Lee Connor of the Screaming Trees, also known as the Microdot Gnome.
Yeah, I use that for a nickname. So I started doing more stuff about 10 years ago, I was going to just use it for a band name, but it was just me. And then I got, was like, well, maybe I'll just go under my name. And then I was like, I'm all confused. So I figure later I was just, well, I'll use it for a nickname and then called the first record down. So,
so it kind of stuck.
Yeah. Huh?
That's kind of neat because I like it, you know, I get it. Ironically, some of the stuff that I know that you've talked about in interviews before that you're influenced by, like the 13th floor elevators and the Doors,
right.
Other stuff like that, I was also into before I ever found your band. So when I found the Trees, oh my God, this is great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew exactly where you were coming from when I first got into you guys. I found you guys
right.
in Nirvana, like probably a lot of people, but.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, some people got us later, some people earlier, some people in between.
Yeah. I think you guys, honestly, and this is not just me brown nosing, I think you guys were, to me, the most impressive band out of the whole scene.
Oh,
I mean,
thanks.
You know, even Kurt was a big fan of you guys, too. And
yeah,
But, like, you guys just had, like, a really psychedelic yet aggressive and emotional feel without – it didn't feel forced. It all felt natural.
No. Well, as we were from such a – you know, being from over the mountains in Ellensburg, we were really isolated. So we were never really part of – I mean, we kind of, like, got to be part of a scene later, but when we started, we weren't part of any kind of scene. It was just us. Doing what we like.
You guys were on SST while everybody else was on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really, I mean, that was, to me, like, I really love being on SST. It was a great label, you know, and a lot of great stuff on SST. And it gave us, like, a freedom to do whatever we wanted to. And it also kind of made us a kind of weirdos in the Seattle scene because, like, everyone was like, who are these guys, like, they're on SST Records and they're from Ellensburg. You know, people were like, because we didn't play Seattle very much until, like, you know, probably 88 or 89 at least. And then, we were touring around the country and stuff. And then every once in a while, I'd come back and play a show or two in Seattle, as opposed to a lot of bands that are playing every weekend in Seattle. You know, we just like maybe do one or two shows a year.
Yeah. But the funny thing is how your band didn't really get lumped. It's more like a lot of those bands, the younger ones at least, because you guys started as far back, your Other Worlds was released in 85.
Yeah, the tape was. Yeah.
Considered along the godfathers like Green River and the rest of them.
Yeah. I know. Well, we didn't think anything was going, we didn't know anything was going on in the Northwest. We were just like, what, you know, we kind of, you know, at some point we heard Green River, and, you know, stuff like in the Melvins and bands. But right at first, I really don't think, I think the only band I remember hearing of from Seattle was the U-Men by, like, you know, we first started around 1985. And every once in a while, we'd go to shows in Seattle and then, you know, buy one or two, like, local records. And there was some stuff out. That was about the only U-Men were the really only ones. And the Young Fresh Fellows, I were hearing them, too.
Yeah. I even know of, like, bands like the 64 Spiders and shit like that.
Oh, yeah.
And
Catbutt.
They are great.
Yeah.
But, so tell me about what it was like growing up in Ellensburg when you decided you wanted to play guitar and when you wanted to be in a rock band and your influences early on and everything.
Yeah, well, it was really small town, about 12,000-13,000 people, including the college. The college is about half the town, Central Washington University.
Yeah.
And other than that, though, it was like the big thing in town was a rodeo, and it was like cow town, you know, a lot of farming and cows and stuff like that. And We didn't have any of the, like, Eastern Washington's sort of known for, like, all the orchards and stuff. We didn't have any orchards. I think they do now, but we didn't. So we didn't really have migrant workers. It was a really white town. Like, there was, like, one black guy in my high school class, you know? So it was, like, it was amazing that we didn't end up being a bunch of racist freaks, but because there were probably plenty of people like that in Ellensburg, but, you know, kind of. But so, you know, it was a tiny little town, and but the way we started, the first way we started getting into music, me and my brother Van, a bass player in the Screaming Trees, was my mom had a box of old 45s, like 50s stuff, including, like, you know, like Bill Haley and Comets and Little Richard, which I was thinking of because he just died. Yeah. Too bad, but he was up there. He was like 87 years old. But that was one of the earliest things we listened to, is Bill Haley and Comets, Little Richard, Elvis, just a lot of the 50s stuff when I was probably like 7 or 8 years old, you know. And then after that, we would go to yard sales in Ellensburg a lot in the early 70s, and everyone was always, like, I don't know, selling all their 60s records, like Beatles and Rolling Stones, and just were buying all these records at yard sales and listening to them. And
stuff I love as well, by the way.
Yeah. Hot what?
I not love the Beatles and claim to be a musician.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles were probably my first real, you know, real love of a band, you know. So I was really influenced by them. But so, you know, and we were fine. Yeah, that's where we got in the Doors, was buying albums from the yard sales. Also, we'd also check out records from the library. The Ellensburg Library actually had quite a few, like, rock albums. I remember they had, like, Satanic Majesty's Request, the Rolling Stones album.
That's a great record, too.
Yeah, and they have the original 3D cover thing, I remember.
I used to have that record as well. Yeah. It got lost in a shed somewhere for a winter and summer, and so they were just ruined. And I was But, yeah, that's a great record, and not a lot of people really speak highly about that record.
That's, like, my favorite Stones record. It's not quite all there, because there's, like, some – the way they tried to tie it together with the sing this all together and all that kind of stuff was real cheesy. But the songs themselves are way darker, you know, a psychedelic sort of thing than Sgt.
Like
Pepper, for instance, which people accuse them of.
And 2000 Man pop out and from that
record. They would have thrown out some of the things, trying to tie it together and put in some of those other songs, like Child of the Moon and, you know, like Dandelion, stuff like, then that would have been probably, you know, like a classic. But it is a classic, but people, you know, it's a lot of people don't like it. I don't think Keith Richards likes it.
I don't think anyway. The really liked it that much.
No, but anyway, so a lot of the records we got from yard sales and from the library. And, you know, I didn't even start buying records till I was in high school, probably. I remember the first two records I bought at a head shop in Ellensburg called Zardo. Like, I never, you know, I wasn't into smoking pot when I was in high school, but I found out they had records there. So it's like, I bought Hotel California and Boston. It was probably 1976, I guess. You know, I was probably a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
So
like mentioning this stuff as influences, completely unashamed of, like, elite hardcore punk only.
I know. Yeah, I mean, that came later, but, you know, like, that was, like, at first, so, you know, there wasn't a lot of places to buy records in Ellensburg, except for places like, you know, there, although, you know, all the grocery stores had records, drug stores had records. Back then, like, all the different stores had records, so you could get all the popular stuff, so, you know, but what really started getting me into, like, not as popular stuff was when I started getting into art rock, because, like, I really got into, when I was, like, I think a sophomore in high school, started getting into Yes. Like prog stuff. Yes, and King Crimson and stuff like that. And most of the time I was in high school, like, I was, like, turned into a total prog rock snob. Art rock, but, yeah, so, like, the
just got four away from me.
Yeah, exactly. So, I was way into, like, all the prog rock stuff I could find. And when punk rock started, you know, appearing, I was pretty skeptical. I was like, I don't know about this. My mom actually really liked a lot of punk rock. I remember at the grocery store, she bought, like, punk rock magazines that would have stuff like Ramones. A lot of the New York stuff was in it. Talking Heads and and television, stuff like that. I didn't listen to it yet, but I was like, saw what it was, and I was kind of, oh, I don't know, maybe. And in 1980, the Ramones were supposed to play in Ellensburg. They ended up canceling the show because they didn't sell any tickets. But it was on the End of the Century tour. I remember seeing the poster of the album cover.
Yeah.
Just like I was a senior in high school or just first year in college or something in 1980. And I'd heard them because I heard of Rock and Roll High School, and my mom had these, you know, punk rock magazines. And,
yeah.
But that was my real first exposure to much punk rock. I heard a little about the Sex Pistols and stuff. But a year or two later after that, in like 80 or 81, we you know, like I said, there was one record store in Ellensburg which started having some newer stuff, Ace Records. This guy, Tim Nelson, passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. He had a record store called Ace Records, and that's where we all would buy records. And that's where I got all the 60s stuff. Like, I discovered Love there and The Doors and 13 Floor Elevators, as well as some new, he had a lot of prog rock stuff. And, you know, and once in a while we go down to Yakima, which is about 30 miles away. They had a couple record stores, not really good ones. But Ace Records was the place where, you know, everyone in Ellensburg who was into music discovered a lot of music. He had a lot of really cool stuff there, you know. Wouldn't think you would find it all.
So
it was really, you know, kind of musically backwards, but there was enough to keep us interested at least, you know, because back then you couldn't look on the internet if you heard of something. You had to either find it in music magazines or go to a record store.
Yeah, it was very much more word of mouth, if anything, back then.
It was like you know, when you heard of a record, like, oh, that's what's really, like, it was a quest to find it. I remember that was like with Easter Everywhere, like the second 13 and 4 Elevators album.
Yeah, it had really rare one.
Sounds, and I read about it, but I hadn't seen it anywhere, and I finally found it. I was on Los Angeles one time, like 84 or 5, and, you know, and I was like, wow, this is, like, even better than the other one, because, or just as good, at least, or not better.
Yeah.
So,
Ben was definitely an innovator for his time that doesn't get his just due either.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, buying records was tough. But I finally, in the early 81, I started listening to XTC, which had a little bit of a prog-ish sort of direction. And that kind of like suddenly opened my mind up more. And I realized that maybe I should start listening. So that's when I suddenly, like about 81, 82, started listening to a lot of other music, like you know, a lot of the new punk rock stuff, like Stephen SST, Black Flag, and Minutemen, and stuff like that, and just anything I could get my hands on, pretty much. So, I stopped being a prog rock snob and just sort of just was looking for anything I could get musically, old or new. And I was also really expanding myself, like into the 60s stuff with the Pebbles collection, and also the English version that was like, came out about that time, called Rubble, which had a lot of the English freak beat stuff on it. So, you know, that was like, I was listening to the punk rock and to like 60s stuff at the same time. And kind of made it up. And that's sort of what ended up becoming at least the early Trees stuff.
Well, when I started playing bass, I learned how to play bass to the first Pink Floyd album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and the first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's classic.
So, I mean, I kind of did the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot, you know, that's a lot of the bands at the same time that I was, newer bands I was listening to, like the Paisley Underground stuff from L.A. had sort of the same thing, especially their earlier, so like the first pre-3 o'clock album was when they were the Salvation Army. It came out as before 3 o'clock, but they were called the Salvation Army at the time. That's like the band that was probably closest to the kind of stuff I felt like, you know, we were doing at first when we first started the band, was it was like punk rock influence and also psychedelic influence. So it was like this weird mix of
a harder edge, modernized version.
Yeah,
is in a way.
Right, exactly.
So, with your own take on it. So when did the Trees start then, and how did you meet Mark?
Yeah, it was the summer of 1985, and Van and Mark Pickerel and I had all, we had been in just some like bands where we were playing covers. We never really even had the idea that we could do original songs. It was sort of like in Ellensburg, you know,
yeah.
All the bands that play were all cover bands. We didn't know how you became a band that would do original songs. It was sort of a mystery, you know. But Van
yeah,
and Mark Pickerel,
beyond your hometown.
Right. I was like, I was
similar, so I understand the mentality of those.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I was a little bit older, and so I was out of high school, and Mark Lanegan, let's see, I was like, Mark Lanegan was two years younger than me, and Van and Mark Pickerel are 4 and 5 years younger than me. So I was out of high school, and
yeah.
Van and Mark Pickerel were still in high school, and they met Lanegan in class, and then they'd go out and party some. I was never in a party or anything, but they would go out drinking and stuff when they were in high school and right out of high school, and they met Lanegan because he was like a pretty prolific sort of partier in Ellensburg, you know, and
yeah,
a lot like later on. But they met up with him, and he was kind of, they kind of talked about being in a band, and he found out they were in a band, and he hadn't really done anything before. I think he sang at a party with some friend's band once, but he, and he played drums some, so. But they were like, Van and Mark Pickerel, they were kind of tired of me, like, being in the band because I guess they thought I was too controlling or something. I don't know. They could tell you why. So they decided they were going to start a band with Mark Lanegan. But the only place they could practice was my room. So my mom actually, I started out playing bass because my mom was like, you guys have to let Lee play bass, because Van, well, we were started out playing covers, like mostly like Black Flag and 60s stuff, because Van had been in a punk rock band called MDL.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And he knew all these Black Flag songs, and so we played like a bunch of those, stuff from like My War and Slipping In,
mm-hmm.
and earlier stuff, and then we also played like, I think like Purple Haze and like Sunshine of Your Love. So that was like still was like, it's like, no, like 60s and 80s punk rock meet each other.
Yeah, like, what the fuck?
And Mark would sing, and because, and then I played bass at the time because my mom was told that I should play bass. But the way the band really started, besides us just playing those covers together, was that I had just got a four track, an X15 cassette four track, and I had been writing some songs because I was out of high school. I always wanted to write songs. I didn't really know how, because I played guitar and stuff. But I started writing poetry. I wrote a lot of poetry the first 2 or 3 years out of high school, and I had like books filled with it. But after I got the four track, I realized, well, I could turn this into songwriting. And so for about a year, I've been writing some songs. And
yeah.
Lanegan, I played them for Lanegan. He was like, "Wow, we should like actually play some of these." I was like, "Oh, okay." So that was really the genesis of Other Worlds. Was he heard these songs. I think we wrote one or two together, like Pictures of My Mind, we sat down and wrote together. But I had him, it was funny because like I think for the demos, we just used the drum. I had a drum machine and stuff. We didn't even have the whole band play it. We just, I sat him down. He sang over the parts, and he didn't really know how to sing yet.
Yeah.
We didn't have any idea, and I don't think he had any idea what amazing voice he had. It was like, you know, you can hear on Other Worlds that his voice is real high, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's definitely a different thing.
Or Baby Lanegan.
Yeah, Baby Lanegan. Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah, by the time we did Clairvoyance, he was discovering he could really sing. But, yeah, that was like, so I sat him down and, you know, had him sing stuff on the four track, and then we had the cassette, and at the same time, we'd heard about the studio, Velvetone, in Ellensburg, that this guy, Sam Albright, had started. And Steve Fisk was working there as an engineer, our first producer. And we had, Steve Fisk, he'd been at Van Pelmel and had some singles and stuff. And they had one of his singles down at Ace Records, and Mark Pickerel had it. And, you know, we thought, you know, to us, he was like famous because he's like a guy who had an actual record, you know. And
yeah,
and he was walking around. We see him walking around town. It's like he has this, it looked like Eraserhead hair, which, you know, in Ellensburg was pretty square. So
yeah,
you know, they're old hippies, but as far as like any like new wavy punk rock type people. They weren't, we were the only ones we knew dressed that way. So this other guy that's around dressing like that and looking weird. So I saw a article by in Spin magazine by Giza X, and it was like called, it was, I can't remember the name of the article, but it was like the gist of it was, you know, don't wait around to get on a record label, do it yourself. It was like, do it yourself. So I was like, okay, well, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
So we heard about the studio, went down and booked time in the studio for, you know, basically, I don't know, we didn't know what we were doing besides just recording. We doing a demo or whatever.
Naturally.
And we took 3 days and recorded Other World. And we didn't really do anything else to it. That was just like, you know, the first thing we ever did right in the studio. We practiced a little bit. We were famous for never practicing any of our songs until we like all those, during all those SST albums, a lot of times we just like give a tape to Pickerel saying, learn like a tape of the demo with the drum machine, learn the song and go, you know, maybe we play it once, maybe not. So, but we actually practiced a little bit, at least enough to be able to play the songs. And that became Other Worlds. And we found out that bands were releasing cassettes. You know, in the mid-80s, cassettes were a pretty big thing for bands, like the cassette revolution. And we found out about Calvin Johnson, Beat Happening, and Kate Cassettes over in Olympia, because Steve Fisk was new, and he'd gone to school over in Evergreen in Olympia.
Beat Happening is another great group that isn't mentioned much either.
No, yeah, they were really influential at the time. We had a lot of early history with them. We did that one record with them, the EP.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's called Screaming Trees, Beat Happening, or Beat Happening, Screaming Trees. It's got four, it's a four-song EP that we recorded one night.
I've heard it.
Yeah, it's on, I think it's on CD, it's on cassette. It's probably on YouTube, you can find it.
Yeah.
But,
I want a physical copy, so see if you can find me a link and let me know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, Calvin helped us. He didn't put it on Kate cassettes, but he helped us distribute it a little bit. So we had some cassettes duped somewhere, I can't remember where, and made a cover and put it out. And at the same time, the guys, Steve and Sam from Velvetone, from the studio, they had a little record label going. They'd released like one record by the Twang Babies, which was some comedy country band that was like kind of a local thing. And, you know, having a... just doing a record, and that was like a big deal. You know, there'd been like one or two bands that we'd heard of in Ellensburg that recorded records that didn't ever do anything. But so they were like, well, you should be on a record label. You know, I mean, we had to finance most of it. We did some like, well, we had like in the early days, like we had my parents' video store that we all worked there. And we practiced in the back of a New World Video. You know,
oh, that's cool.
That was like, we traded them some like VCRs they were using for crazy really early version of a DAT machine that was Claire Warren's is actually mastered on it.
Oh really?
Like, yeah, it was like they had it was a digital converter that you hooked up to VCR, and they were using Betamax. We had these really high-end Betamax VCRs that we traded them for studio time, and then you'd hook your tape machine in to the converter and then record it onto the Betamax VCR. And that's how Clairvoyance was actually mastered that way.
Wow.
Even though, yeah, I know. It was like really crazy. Like it was digitally mastered. Probably one of the early records was digitally mastered.
Yeah, I've actually heard of that if you're recording certain things like off the radio and stuff.
Yeah.
My buddy used to record them on the blank VHS tapes because quality was the highest you could get.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. So I don't know if we had the.
They've heard of it before. I'll say it. I can't vouch either way.
Yeah. Right.
But that's really funny that's how Clairvoyance was made. And both those records.
Yeah. It was really odd because, you know, we did it all. It was like an 8-track Velvetone. In fact, all the stuff we did. The first three records and Other Worlds were all on the 8-track Otari machine at Velvetone. They had a really beautiful studio. It was huge, but it just has a little tiny 8-track.
Oh, wow.
But we managed to do three and a half albums, an EP on there. You know,
they
really
got
stretched it to this. Yeah. Steve Fisk was great with the thing. I mean, he you know, he knew all sorts of old studio tricks and stuff, and he'd, you know, I mean, that's the way they had to do it in the 60s with, you know, the eight tracks is a lot of tracks, probably for at least the mid-60s. By the end of the 60s, they started getting 16 to 24. But
yeah.
So, you know, everything we did up to through Invisible Lantern was all on eight track in Ellensburg there. And yeah, I know. I mean, we tried different, you know, it's like weird because like Clairvoyance had like a louder drum sound, and I remember Steve had weird, he got the drum sound by gating like white noise and like a low tone for the kick drum.
Oh, that's cool.
But then like by the time we got to Invisible Lantern, we were like, we want the guitars and the voice real loud. So everyone always get criticized for that album not having the drums very loud at all. Like some people call it invisible drums. But that was what at least me and Lanigan were going for. We had to fight Steve Fisk on that code. That's what we wanted at the time, and that's what we got. So,
well, that's another great record as well.
Yeah, that's my favorite record of all the old Screaming Trees, at least the earlier stuff. I mean, just because it's more, you know, it's more like what I would have done.
Yeah,
myself, I guess. I don't know, but just because, I mean, it's my personal favorite. It's, you know, it's not, I don't think it's like the best thing we ever did, but it's just, you know, kind of.
Yeah, well,
my,
every artist has that. You know, I'd say mine somewhere between the last album you guys did and Clairvoyance, honestly, is my favorite. Like, it's somewhere in between those two. I can't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they're totally different records that I just love for different reasons.
Yeah.
The same band.
Yeah, well, you know, like every record we did, we tried to do the best record we could do. We never, you know, the like Other Worlds was like, you know, we just went in the studio to record. We didn't really know what we were doing. But after that, it was like, you know, we spent a lot of time on a lot of the records, especially the first, especially when Invisible Lantern, those two took like months, you know, because we didn't have to finish it real fast because we just kept going back in the studio, and Clairvoyance too. We'd take several months just, you know, going back in the studio every week or two, and new songs would come along, and, you know, and then in the middle of doing, even if especially when we got signed to SST, because we had been down to, after we got Clairvoyance all finished up, we, Steve knew some people, the guy Ray Farrell worked at SST and some other people down in California. We did a short California tour, and some of the people came to see us, and Greg Ginn really liked Other Worlds. That was like the thing. He liked Other Worlds a lot. And, that was what the, you know, he called us up at the video store one day, like in early 1987, after we'd been down to California. And it was like, he wasn't saying like, he just kept beating around the bush. Lanigan was talking to him, and finally Lanigan says, well, what, you want to sign your label? Like, he's like, oh, yeah, that'd be cool. And we're like, you know, that was the coolest thing. To me, that was like the coolest thing ever. That was way better than getting signed to Epic. But it's probably like the best thing that happened my whole life was like getting signed to SST. And
yeah,
it worked really well.
Spread, you know?
Yeah. You know, I mean, they SST, like all record labels, have their ups and downs and stories about them and stuff. And, you know, they paid us some money. Some bands, they never paid anybody anything, you know. But
yeah, I know St. Vitus were on their label, and I don't know for sure. I don't know if you know St. Vitus or not.
Yeah, I know they are. I don't know them personally, but I really used to listen to them.
Yeah, because you guys were making records for them around the same time then.
Yeah.
They left, I think, around after 88. So.
Yeah.
But yeah. I never heard anything definitive saying anything bad occurred, but like, you know,
well, they did like what a lot of happens to a lot of record labels. They just get too many bands, and that was, you know, they had so many great bands, and then a lot of the bands decided either, you know, well, I'm not, you know, to move on to another label, and that's pretty much what everybody did. A lot of the bands on SST, you know, sometimes they got some of the bands that were like Sonic Youth or Husker Du. They're already pretty big in the underground at the time.
Yeah,
but you know, and some of the bands like Dinosaur Jr., for instance, got big when they were on SST. But
yeah,
They're fantastic as well.
We just had too big a roster, you know, and you just can't, you know, the amount of money you have to. Yeah, and the thing with SST was the coolest thing about them was that you didn't have to, you know, there was no artistic interference whatsoever. It was just like, I want to make a record. And if you like made a record, you scream at the top of your lungs with, you know, fuck you for like 40 minutes, they would probably release it. You know, it was just like,
yeah.
You tell them you want to do another record, and they did it. I mean, at least when we were on the label, that's what every time, you know, we want to do another record. Okay, well, you know, go in the studio, and we'll pay for it or whatever. So, you know, I couldn't complain. Artistically, it was great. There was no problem I could ever discern artistically being an SST. It was just like by the time we got around to Buzz Factory, there were starting to be some problems. Like, for instance, like we had our tour plan, spring tour 89 was like, you know, the same time when Buzz Factory was supposed to come out. But we get out on tour and the record wasn't out. This is when they started having some problems, you know, money wise, getting the records out was kind of a problem. So,
yeah, it's problematic.
Yeah. And plus, just artistically, we're kind of like, well, we did all these records and we've been touring for years, you know, 2 or 3 years. And what are we going to do now? And it was kind of like, well, let's few other bands. It seemed like a Meat Puppets were getting signed to major labels. So we thought, let's try that, you know? Because every record we did just did a little bit better. And we did more tours and we sold a few more. And, you know, and it wasn't like we were ever thought we'd ever make any money on SST, you know, at least maybe a couple dollars here and there, but nothing, not enough to make a living on. And it was some sort of, you know, idea that maybe you can make a living if you were on a major label, which is iffy, even if you're on a major label, especially if you it's not easy. But
tell me about the signing to the major label and how did that impact the band and the music by that point? Because from Clairvoyance on, even through Buzz Factory, your style kind of started to metamorphosize, so to speak, into what it became.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we finished the tours for Buzz Factory in 89, and that was kind of our next goal, was to try to get signed. And in the meantime, some, like, things had changed some. Like, Mark Lanegan moved over to Seattle. I think at some point Mark Pickerel moved to Seattle during that time. And so we weren't, like, in the same town anymore, which was a little different. And I was still writing stuff the same way, just, you know, writing songs on my 4-track. In Ellensburg, and that pretty much continued on for the songs through at least through Uncle Anesthesia, and those songs were a lot like the songs that you know, just the writing process and stuff of me writing and then landing and taking it, changing some of the lyrics, maybe none of the lyrics, maybe all the lyrics. It depends on the song, you know.
Yeah.
So we decided we needed to get a manager in order to get signed, so we hooked up with Susan Silver, because, like, I guess, so, you know, we knew Soundgarden, they were friends of ours, and after she managed, she said, yeah, we'll try to get you signed to a label. So and Soundgarden had just got signed to A&M, and they, you know, so
were they the first ones out of the scene?
I think they were the first Seattle band to get signed. We were fairly early too, because by the time when we got signed, you know, the Epic, it was like early 1990. They had no idea what to do with us. I don't really know why they signed us, but our A&R guy, Bill Pfeiffer, who signed us, are really cool. Bob Pfeiffer, I mean. Bob Pfeiffer. He was our A&R guy from Epic, and he was always real supportive of us. But, you know, we just, it was sort of an anticlimactic thing. I mean, we just signed this huge contract, you know, all that SST contracts were like one page. This was like some huge, like 2 inches thick or something. And
right,
I don't know what was in it. I have no idea. But signed it anyway. Huh?
You're telling me you didn't even read that contract?
Well, I didn't. We had a lawyer read it for us, I suppose.
Oh.
I'm sure somebody would have. Yeah, I mean, the SST one you could read. The SST one's weird. I mean, the SST ones were like really simple, but they pretty much, like, they don't say, like, after a certain amount of time you'll get your records back, which is sort of a problem. I mean, you know, we've thought about, like, you know, re-releasing and stuff, but SST keeps, like, they're weird because, like, sometimes they've gone for several years and they pay us, but, like, over the last 10 years they've re-released a lot of stuff and they have it digitally now, and we haven't heard from them for you know, since like, I think what they paid us something like in 2010.
Oh, wow.
And definitely sell stuff, you know, I mean, so.
Yeah.
And and that was like before anything was really being sold digitally or streamed or anything, so.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a huge amount of money, but it's enough to be like, why aren't you paying us? I don't know.
It's still something that, you know.
Yeah. But,
the records, those records were pretty much the same then?
Huh?
But the writing process for the records,
yeah,
from
Invisible Eye, yeah, it was just taking the songs. You know, I guess, you know, Clairvoyance was actually a little bit different because we sort of like hadn't got into a groove of doing it. I think we wrote a lot more stuff, at least together on Clairvoyance. But then by the time, you know, Even If, Invisible Lantern, and all the way through Uncle Anesthesia was, you know, my 4-track stuff going to Mark and him, you know, being mostly an editor, but, you know, sometimes every once in a while we sit down and write stuff together, but over the more time went on, you know, it's kind of like trying to get along.
Yeah.
You know, I never really got along as great friends or anything, so it's kind of like, you know.
I mean, obviously there's been some harsh words said, and I'm not in all the, you know, all that, what have you, but I mean, you guys, regardless of whatever you had, you seem to at least appreciate the musical legacy that it
I mean, that's what I always thought. That's what I always thought that, I mean, I don't know. After reading some of Mark's book, I was like, maybe sort of second guess what he was always trying to do. But to me, even all the like not getting along, you know, basically by being like a dysfunctional family, the one overriding goal was to make the best music that we possibly could. And I don't know. I guess he apparently wanted to be famous.
Rock and roll and dysfunction go together very well, it seems, and it's almost natural anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read his whole book, but this, you know, I've heard a lot about it, read a couple pages, and it seems like somehow he wanted to be famous, which was, for anybody else, at least for me and my brother, that didn't have an interest in famous. So we just wanted to be in a band, you know, like a real band that made music and made records, and you know, having your, you know, peers in the world know about you and stuff. That was
really what it's all about.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So, the writing process was pretty much the same up to Uncle Anesthesia, which changed quite a bit, at least for Sweet Oblivion. It kind of went back to the way by dust, but Sweet Oblivion was the one that really, for some reason, I guess it was just we were kind of like, you know, Mark suddenly decided that he wanted a lot more to do with writing songs, so he would come over and work with us a lot. We spent a lot more time together with me and the band.
About Winter Song, writing that. Can you elaborate?
Go ahead. What's that?
Can you elaborate on the story you did the other
day?
Winter Song.
Yeah, that was one of the few songs. I mean, you know, we didn't really write that together because we were all done writing all the songs. We were going in the studio in just a few days, flying to New York to record the record. But I mean, Mark did have something to do with it because he inspired me to write it partially, because I was like, you know, I was in my apartment in Seattle at 6 o'clock in the morning. He comes and knocks on the door, and it was his like drug and alcohol thing. That's a weird story because he did not like when we first started the band. He had been, like I was telling you, in high school, you know, really big drinker and Helly in Ellensburg. In general, you know, known for being a big partier, but he was working in pea fields with combines and, you know, trucks in Eastern Washington, and he got run over, his legs did, and he got hurt. He didn't break him, but he had he couldn't walk for a while. This was right when we started the band, I guess he just was like, I gotta stop drinking, I'm gonna die. I think maybe the doctor told him that if he didn't stop drinking and doing drugs, he was gonna die. So the whole
SST period for the Screaming Trees, as far as I know, maybe I'm wrong, he was sober.
Okay.
Until like 1990 or so. And suddenly in 1990, he started smoking pot again for a while, and then he started drinking. So the dynamics completely changed of what was going on. And the weird thing is, it coincided with Sweet Oblivion, was that I don't think, as far, you know, he may have been doing some heroin here and there, but mostly he was drinking. And when Mark would drink, he'd suddenly be really, really social. Which is, you know, when you, I guess most heroin addicts aren't terribly social, so maybe other heroin addicts, but, and he wanted to, like, rehearse, he wanted to, like, be together, write songs, he wanted to do all this stuff, and suddenly it was like we were all a band together doing stuff instead of just me writing songs and then together playing them on stage in the studio. So, so that was, like,
made it
a lot easier. It was a lot easier on me because I wasn't suddenly that pressured to like being writing all these songs for Mark, you know, like come over and work on them with us. So
it felt more organic than a task list.
Anyway, that day when I wrote Winter Song, he comes over 6 a.m. and I hardly never drink, you know, a little bit here and there. He wants to start drinking beer with him at 6 a.m. He'd been all up all night long. And I remember I like poured the beer out, and he's like, "No, you have to drink it or something." But then I don't remember exactly why or what we did, but he called Van and Barrett, and we all drove around. And Van had this really shitty old Saab; we couldn't even fit all of us hardly. But we drove around doing something. What the hell do we do? There was some strip club that he wanted to go see. Some porn star, Nina Hartley, who was like a famous porn star in the 80s, was like appearing at the, what was the name of that place? The Lusty Lady, I think, down on First Avenue, right next to Pipelix Market. And he wanted, that was the last, like, we drove around doing all this stuff. He was talking about that the last time we saw Mark that day was you dropped him off there. I don't know if he went and saw her or not. Then after that, I was like, I'd been up since 6 o'clock. So I went home and I talked to my, it was a girl at the time, my wife now, Janet. And she was like, talking about songs, about music. And she was like, I guess maybe I was thinking about writing a song. And she said I should listen to Cheap Trick song, Down. You know, that song, Down, Down in My Head.
Yeah.
And she played it for me on the phone. And after that, I wrote a Winter Song. It doesn't really have, you know, it's got maybe a couple of chords in common or something, but
yeah,
that song and the day of Lanigan doing all the, like, driving around Seattle, wake me up at 6 o'clock in the morning. That was the Jesus knocking thing, was like, you know, it was Lanigan knocking the door, not Jesus.
That's awesome, and that's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever realized that or I ever told him. But he's singing it, so it's kind of funny. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's an example of, like, you know, a lot of the older songs. I'd give him the song, and he'd write one or two lines. On some of them he'd change everything. Some of them he'd change the title. You know, like, there's an old song called Pathway from Even If and Especially When. That song, he wrote all the lyrics. I had a different title, and, you know, so it just depends on the song. But that one, yeah, that one song, what line was he wrote? It was like raindrops fall away like souls. I think he wrote that line, maybe one or two others. It's a little bit different, of course, but, you know. But, not, you know, he was like, it was a lot like being an editor for him, I think, you know. Like, that's what book editors do. Sometimes book editors write whole chapters of a book, you know. And they weren't, and I think that was part of being the thing when he was starting his solo career, is he wanted to write songs. I don't know why, we never could figure out why Mark never brought a song to the Screaming Trees and said, here's a song of mine, let's do it. It was always like, that's a good song, why don't we work on that, of minor bands. I don't know why he never did. A couple times I heard him playing songs like that. There's a song called Dead on You, I think it's on Whiskey for the Holy Ghost.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, that would be a really cool song. We should do that. You know, it would have mixed up the melodies and stuff because his stuff has a different sort of, you know, meter and melody and stuff than my stuff, the band stuff.
But he never did for some reason. I don't know. And that was about the same time, too, as we were looking for the manager. Epic was when he started his solo career with that. You know, we were all doing solo albums. Like, I did the Purple Outside record, and Van did, he had a band called Solomon Grundy. And the original idea was actually, like, to do, like, the Kiss albums, you know, the Kiss solo albums on SST.
Yeah.
But Lanigan had moved over to Seattle and got hooked up with Sub Pop, and then they put ours on New Alliance, which was, like, a SST. It was, like, the label that Mike Watt had started.
Yeah.
It was, like, a subsidiary. So, yeah, but we all had solo albums come out that year, including Mark's Whiny Sheet album. And so, you know, he was writing songs for that at the same time that we were working on trying to get signed, and then working on Uncle Anesthesia. But at the same time, Mark Pickerel, I never realized until years later that apparently Mark Pickerel had talked to Lanigan about he wanted to, like, write songs and sing some, but Mark was like, no, or didn't want to have anything to do with it. You know, because later, Pickerel's done a lot of albums and singing and playing guitar and stuff. But I didn't realize he wanted to do that back then. Or, you know, I would have been, okay, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But, so Pickerel was in the process of leaving. He kind of left in two steps. He told us, I guess, right around the time we were getting signed to Epic, that he was going to leave the band, because we had, when we went to Europe in the second time, in first time we went to Europe was in winter 89, then winter 1990, we were working on getting signed, and we went to Europe, but he didn't want to go with us, so we had a friend of ours, Sean Hollister, who was in a band, Ellensburg band called King Crap, and he was also in bands, band Solomon Grundy, he played drums with us on that tour. But Mark Pickerel was still going to record the record Uncle Anesthesia was.
Oh, okay.
So that's, yeah, so it was kind of weird because he was leaving the band when we recorded Uncle Anesthesia. We knew that was going to last thing he was going to do. In fact, that's why I don't know who decided on the back of the album. It's just the three of us. There's no drummer on the album.
Yeah.
But that was the last thing Mark Pickerel did with us, too. So that was definitely a difference, and we were kind of floating around for a couple of years not really knowing what we were going to do for a drummer as far as, you know, like permanently, because we had Hollister play with us also on fall tour. We did a Social Distortion, like it was like they were on Epic, and like, you know, Epic's like, we'll do a tour with another Epic band, they like that kind of stuff. So we did a tour with Social Distortion in the fall of 1990 with Sean Hollister playing drums, and then that was a really chaotic time, too, because Van was also, he'd left the band, I don't like, in 1988 for about 6 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This woman, Donna Dresch, would play with us. You might see some pictures of us with her. She played with us for a few months on a tour in 1988, a tour for Invisible Lantern in the U.S. And then Van came back. He was like, he had a kid and had to have like three jobs because, I mean, we didn't make any money at all from the band. And so, you know, a little bit later on, but we didn't make any at all at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had to quit because he had a kid and had to get married and stuff in 1980.
That's understandable, though.
Yeah. So, but he came back to the band after for Buzz Factor and stuff and was still in the band, but he went off and played with Dinosaur Jr. He played, this one after Lou was left or kicked out of Dinosaur Jr. He was, Jay was looking for a bass player and he found Van. At least he played with him on tour for a while in late 1990. And so when we actually came time for us to do tours for Buzz Factory, we didn't know what we were going to do because we didn't have a drummer. And Van, we weren't even sure if Van was still in the band.
Yeah.
Very beginning of 1991. And so Mark had lined up to get Donna Dresch, who played with us before, to play with us. And a friend of hers, a lady from, I don't know what band she was in. She was from Washington, D.C. And we even went so far as to, like, she sublet her apartment in Washington, D.C. and was going to come out. But I guess I really wanted Van back in the band the way it was. And so I got the idea to ask Dan Peter for Mudhoney to play drums, because I knew he was sort of, at the time, Mudhoney wasn't doing a lot of stuff. And he'd been playing with Nirvana. I either called him or went over to Seattle and talked to Dan. He was like, yeah, that'd be really cool. At least play with you for a while, like do a tour with it. So then I called Van, and I guess it wasn't going that well with Jay, with Dinosaur Jr. I don't know what all the stories are talking about, but he was on a tour with them. They were opening for Jane's Addiction, so I can't imagine what that must have been like. Dinosaur Jr. Opening for Jane's Addiction in 1990, so no. So we got Dan Peters, practiced probably a couple times with him, and went on a tour with Dan Peters on drums and Van back and everything else. Pretty much intact for the tour from Alcohol and Seizure. But two or three days into the tour, we had, for the first time, we had like a equipment van and we rented a small minivan, Aerostar van, for us to ride in. And Mark Lanning was riding in the equipment van with our two road guys. And we were going through Wyoming and turned it over and wrecked the thing and totaled the van. And amazingly, nobody was hurt physically, at least. They took everyone in everyone else except for the two road guys in Lanigan were unscathed. We didn't have a wreck. The van did. We saw it on the back. And we were stuck in the middle of Wyoming for a couple of days. Everyone went to the hospital and got checked out. They were okay. But it took us I was just a while back, I was looking at that itinerary, that tour, and I don't know, we canceled that one for the shows. Every group that went ended up, I think, Chicago. We had to cancel a bunch of Midwest shows and stuff like that. But when we finally got back together, Lanigan had suddenly decided to start drinking again, which was quite a trip. And that was about 30 days of complete debauchery and insane drinking. And Dan was, he liked drinking too. So he was like, hey, this is fun.
Yeah.
Dan Peters. I never drank very much. I mean, I drank here and there, but I was never a big drinker or pot smoker or anything. I was like the only person that didn't have an addiction problem, I guess. I don't know why everybody else. I don't know about Mark Pickerel, but Barrett was like, he was like having alcohol problems too, on and off. Pickerel, I don't think, as far as I know, at least back then, never did. But Van's always had problems with drinking and cocaine and stuff. And of course, Lanning and stuff is infamous. And anyway, that was a drunk tour. And boy, they were like, we got through to like about two-thirds way through the tour down to Pensacola, Florida, and they couldn't take anymore because he was just physically fucked up, from drinking every day, like starting drinking in the morning and all day. And so we sort of didn't know what was going to happen after that, because we'd done the Epic album last season, we did the tour. It was middle of 1991, and there wasn't really anything musically, except for, there was the underground stuff. Nirvana was biggest in the underground. They were on the cover of NME and Melody Maker in England, and Sub Pop was getting pretty big. But, that was still like the college rock thing that we'd been involved in all along. It didn't have anything to do with the big, top 40 music scene like was coming up a few months, like we had no idea, so
actually
kind of like
at all.
Yeah, so we came back in the summer of 1991, didn't really know what we were going to do, and I think probably Lanning was probably thinking of just hanging it up and doing a solo career, and I didn't really know what to do. I was still, I guess I was, I think I'd finally moved over to Seattle at that point, maybe, from Ellensburg, but anyway. So we decided that we'd either, we asked Dan Peters if he wanted to keep going. And, we were like, well, if you're going to, if you don't want to quit Mud Honey, then you better keep going with those guys. And, that was his band and we totally understood. So we looked for a drummer and we always just take the first person we stumble upon. We stumble upon Barrett, which ended up being a huge blessing because he really, kicked us in the butt musically. It was like, I always compare like Pickerel was like Keith Moon and Barrett was like John Bonham. So it kind of changed us somewhat musically.
Definitely. I would definitely
make
that comparison.
Yeah. I mean, and we, uh, So yeah, in fact, a good example is like in the middle of this was like we'd started writing songs already. We kind of decided like, you know, we're going to do it differently this time. We're going to all get together and write songs together and make it more like a group effort instead of just me writing the songs and giving them to Mark, you know. So and we got together for the first time to practice with Barrett. And then a couple weeks later, we practiced some of the songs for the first time with Dan Peters, like Shout of the Season we'd just written. And he didn't really understand the song at all. You know, he was kind of like, I don't get this, because it was, you know, it's not like a punk rock thing you could play. But like Barrett, you know, we played the demo for him, we played it, he just instantly understood what was going on with it. And, you know, that was like great. So we spent 6 months, 8 months rehearsing and writing stuff together, and we'd get together and rehearse. And like Lanigan wouldn't want to stop rehearsing. It used to be before that, we'd like be lucky if he'd ever even come to a rehearsal, you know, like later that was like that again. But during that year, when we were working on Sweet Oblivion, it was like we'd get together and we would play. Barrett had a place where we could rehearse, and we just keep going. And Mark would be, no, we got to keep practicing. And we do stuff like, you know, just play through the songs. And like instead of just rehearsing the song, say, okay, do it again. We'd like play through the grooves of them, you know, like jam on for a while. We did that with, I remember Nearly Lost You. Because Van wrote Nearly Lost You after him and, I think him and Lanigan went back over to Ellensburg for some reason. And like Van was on taking acid or something, and he had the epiphany, wrote the chorus, maybe the chorus part of that song. And then we worked on some of the verses and stuff with him and me together. And then Mark was like, you know, this is really different. You know, it's like a kind of different groove, and it could be a single maybe. And so we really worked on that song a lot. You know, we would just keep playing it over and over again, like through that funky kind of groove of it.
A great song.
Yeah, it really paid off because that song was our, somehow, you know, it was our biggest hit. But with help being on the single soundtrack, that was a good, good thing to happen. Not sure, but of course, in the middle of us doing these rehearsals and writing the songs in the fall of 1991, suddenly Nirvana, they hit with Smells Like Teen Spirit came out. I remember being at a barbecue at Dan Peters' house, and Kurt was there, but Chris was there, and he was playing the tape of it. And I was really a huge Nirvana fan, so I was like, "Whoa, this is really cool, kind of different." Not really; it didn't seem different to me. It didn't seem commercial or anything. In fact, it seemed less poppy than like a lot of their other stuff, because, you know, the stuff between, I mean, Nirvana, even on Bleach, had always, there was this kind of pop aesthetic that was woven into the really heavy stuff. But, you know, the stuff that they've been playing live, a lot of stuff like In Bloom and, well, like Sliver was like that, you know, songs that really had more of a poppy chorus and stuff. It smells like Teen Spirit didn't seem like that to me at all. It was much less. It was very obscure in a way, but it was a huge hit. I don't know how that happened, because Lithium is like way more like, you know, that's like, seems like the logical huge hit. Not that those weren't big hits too, but so I knew something was going on. The Paramount show, the Nirvana Paramount show on Halloween in 1991, all of guys and every band or women who were at the show, at the Paramount, hanging out in the lobby, including Nirvana, like everybody does at all shows.
Yeah.
At this event. You know, and Nirvana's just like hanging out in the lobby too. And we were talking to Kurt and Chris, and they were saying, man, we sold like 300,000 records. And everyone's mind was blown because, you know, maybe 50,000 was the most records the bands itself, you were the biggest college rock band, you know, maybe, but something like that. And that was like, you know, and of course, that was probably the last time that they ever could stand out in front of the place, at least in Seattle, and just like hang out without people mobbing them or something.
Oh, yeah.
That was like the cusp of the fame. It was like the day before and the day after that, that Halloween show. That was when things changed. And, you know, after that, we finished up writing songs, flew to New York. And so we were in New York for about a month. Recording Sweet Oblivion with John Fleming and John in Yellow. And came back to Seattle, and a lot of stuff was going on. But we started doing shows fairly soon, probably in the spring, like a lot of European stuff. That was when we went to England a little bit and
Italy, and we play the Reading Festival, the famous in Boston, when Kurt came out in a wheelchair and stuff.
Oh yeah, nice.
Yeah, that was fun. That was like total Seattle days. Like the Melvins, us and the Melvins, Mudhoney, Nirvana, and a couple of like L7. They're not from Seattle, but and Nick Cave too. That was quite a day.
That would have been a day.
Yeah, I didn't watch Nirvana though. It's like I felt horrible. I was so tired after the whole day of like watching bands and like everything. But I stayed in the dressing room, and I remember Kurt having that robe on. I was like, what the hell is he doing? I don't know. And like, I heard about it later. I heard him play in like in the dressing room, but I kicked myself for not watching that. Cause...
Yeah. I turned a year old the day you guys played that show on August 30th, 92.
No kidding. Yeah.
I turned a year old that day, so that's kind of that happened on my birthday.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's funny because I've always identified with the older stuff and more of the generation before mine.
That's cool. Yeah, it's cool if people, I mean, I think, you know, I'd say, you know, usually when I see some people are fans, I mean, people, you know, between like 40 and 60 years old are like our most fans, but there are younger people who are into us too, which is really cool. I mean, I was like that too, you know, I listened to all 60s bands in the 80s.
Yeah.
So.
I listened to everything from the old folk music of Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly up to modern stuff and stoner metal and everything.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to do it. I mean, being into one type of music is sort of like vanilla flavor. It's like you only listen to just doom rock or different kind of prog rock or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, I try to listen to as much different stuff as I can, including newer stuff, you know. So.
Yeah. And that's the thing that, you know, I like about your solo stuff, too, is you can hear, you know, elements of the tree.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
Like your thing, and it's your thing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I like the way you were able to, I mean, the Microdot Gnome, I listened to that record the other day.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's great. Psychic.
Thanks.
Whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, I spent the first 10 years after the band, really. There wasn't really a forum like there is now on the internet. You know, it was just starting out, you know, streaming music and selling stuff online. And I, you know, kind of was like, I don't know. You know, I'd done that Purple Outside record, but I hadn't really, I had never had another band besides the Screaming Trees. Like, the Screaming Trees was my band. That's what I was writing songs for. So.
You were very proud in the Hype documentary.
Yeah. Oh, that's Van. That's my brother. He's in the Hype documentary.
Oh, okay.
It's okay. We look alike sometimes.
You look a lot alike.
Yeah. A lot of people mistake us. That mistake. One time when we were, it was probably in the 80s, like one time Van had just gone into a mini-mart in Ellensburg, and I didn't know it, and I went in, and the guy said, like, back for more snacks, huh? The guy thought I was Van. I don't know. It was like, oh, okay. We looked out for Shalai. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, so when I started.
The trees are a ton of bands, so fuck them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, some people, like the major label people, were kind of like, oh, these guys are too fat to be famous, but like our A&R guy was really cool about that. I mean, you know, it's like, well, yeah, you're gonna, the skinny guys you're gonna like forget about in 10 or 20 years, and you'll remember these big guys because
Gary Garcia was a fat man that played guitar.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. So anyway. Yeah, I mean, I figure one of the reviews and it was a really early review of Bruce Pavitt, and he's a Sub Pop column in The Rocket, and he said the Screaming Trees are fat and they sweat like pigs, which is totally true. So, and I, you know, it looked like, you know, you could have taken it in a bad way, but he meant it in a total in a good way. You know, that was like,
yeah,
I always remember that because, you know, people remember that anyway. So,
it almost sounds like something Iggy Pop would write a song based around.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Where it's a negative thing, but it gives it a positive in some nihilistic way.
Yeah, I can see that. It's true.
No, but I totally get that. And I mean, I've never really cared about what a band looks like. If the sound sounds good to me. That's all that matters.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, that's what's important is the sound.
Thank you guys for helping kill some of the hair metal bands that were just...
Yeah. I know. I mean, it sucks because, I mean, a lot of those bands were influenced by a lot of really good bands like New York Dolls or...
Yeah.
Stuff like that, but they just took it to this, like, I think it wasn't necessarily even the way the bands looked, it was just the attitude. It was like, you know, we're better than you and fuck you. That was like, you know, and I think that's like when the attitude of the Seattle bands was like, we're all friends and we're just like, you know, we like each other's bands, and you know, there wasn't a competition. There was maybe a competition, you know, to do something good, but not a competition to be better than the other bands, you know. That was never
that
the Seattle scene was. And that's totally the way the hair metal bands were, I think.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's so much disdain.
A lot of them, and Bobby Liebling from the band Pentagram, he even said this. He said, it's a real shame that some of those bands played like dog shit because they looked cool and they were influenced by cool bands.
Yeah, exactly.
He's actually good friends with Johnny Thunders, too. Like,
oh, yeah.
But, like, he's like, yeah, a lot of them played like dog shit.
Yeah, I bet they did. Yeah, I can't imagine. So.
Like, you just think back to that period in time of what life was like and what music was like, and that was after the MRC thing, and the White Lions, and the Warrants, and the Dumb.
I know. And they were, like, all the biggest thing. Yeah, one time we actually played with, I don't know how this happened, but the band Firehouse, which is one of the hair metal bands. Yeah, we were in North Carolina, and somehow this one show on tour in a college, this was probably like on the Sweet Oblivion tour or something, but we were playing, and it's funny because we did a lot of shows with Firehose, you know, Mike Watt, the guys from the Minutemen, but this was Firehouse, and they were like a hair metal band, and it wasn't packed, but there were quite a few people there to see us, and all those people left. I don't know if more people came and saw Firehouse, but they were kind of confused. I think I was kind of confused too, because I didn't know how we got. But that was like after that whole scene. You know, they probably had been playing arenas like 2 or 3 years before, at least opening up for Poison or something like that.
Started and really started to rise just as you were plowing them down like wheat.
Right. I know. Yeah. Well, the weird thing about the whole the whole grunge explosion, you know, grunge was like a funny word, like, because
I was
scared
to say that because I thought your brother would hit me through the phone like you said.
Right.
VH1 special.
Well, the thing with the word grunge is, I don't know where the word grunge was around before Nirvana got big. And it was just, but it was still kind of just like a joke, you know. People joke, oh, we're grunge, you know. Like,
yeah, Mark Arm took the blame for that and said,
yeah,
that.
Right. But after it happened, we joked even more because it was so funny. But, you know, I mean, somebody, you know, the music industry needs a label. So nowadays, I don't even think twice about it. You know, I used to go, we're not a grunge band. You know, we don't sound anything like grunge, but we never did. But, you know.
You do share certain similarities, I guess, in the way you guys just did whatever the fuck you wanted to do.
Well, yeah.
Expectations. But that's the thing. You guys don't sound anything like Nirvana. Nirvana doesn't sound anything like Alice in Chains.
Yeah, I know. None of them
and,
really
like,
sound.
You know, and some people don't like this band, and I can understand if you don't, but Stone Temple Pilots doesn't sound anything like the others either.
No.
Well, they had a bit of psychedelia to their sound, so they may be...
Well, it's weird, because their first album, when the first album came out, I was like, these guys are just, like, completely copying everyone. Because they had, like, one song sound like Pearl Jam, one song sound like Nirvana, and one sound like Alice in Chains or something.
Yeah.
The second record was suddenly like, wait, I guess these guys are actually different. You know, they didn't sound anything like...
Well, I've heard people say that Alice in Chains was more of a hair band.
They were told... Well, see, I was talking to my brother a while back about this, about the differences in the Seattle bands. You know, there were like the bands like Nirvana and us that were out from outside of Seattle. And then there were the bands that were from like Bellevue and stuff, like the, you know, kind of like the rich kids, like probably like the guys at Pearl Jam or some of those bands. And then there were kind of like the
white trash North Seattle guys, which was like Alice in Chains, like a lot of hair metal bands, and they used to, there was certain places they'd play, like up in North Seattle. Yeah, and like if you see early pictures of like everybody, like Lane had like long like hair metal hair and stuff. And
I played, my one friend plays guitar one of their early demos for the song Social Parasite, and he said it sounded like Skid Row.
Right. Well,
so that's Fox Skid Row, not Nirvana Skid Row.
It's wild to realize that Alice in Chains was completely different because Jerry plays guitar a little bit. He's definitely influenced by some metal stuff more than some of the other grunge players. But they're like, actually, in retrospect, they're one of my favorite bands of the time. And
we've seen them
a couple times.
I recently finally got to see them live, and they were playing with Korn, and that makes me cringe. Although Korn put on a good show for what they're worth, they're not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
But Alice in Chains still does phenomenally well, even though Lane's not there. I think they went about that the right way and not trying to, like, replace him. Because Jerry actually wrote a lot of the early shit.
Yeah, I know. It was like, Jerry had... That was a little bit like our band, like, where Jerry was definitely one of his main songwriters. And he sang a lot of the stuff in harmony with Lane, too. So that kind of...
Yeah, and they did a lot of really unique harmonies and really...
Yeah.
Beautiful. That's the only thing I can say. And Jerry seems like a really down-to-earth guy, like someone you could have a beer with.
Yeah, that's cool. Lane was cool, too. He was very, I don't know. He's bad influence. Either Mark was a bad influence on him or vice versa. I'm not sure which, but he was...
Well, Mark does say he was a bad influence on people like Kurt and stuff when he feels guilty. I read a couple interviews.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. So.
But I know we got to talking about the End of the Trees and the Microdome album, but can we backtrack a little bit? So after Sweet Oblivion, you guys went on a hiatus. You weren't involved in Mad Season, obviously, but what was that project and what was...
I haven't really heard much about it at the time, because I was involved in trying to write songs, and that was all I was involved in for like about 2 years for the next record. Because after we finished the touring for fall 1993, suddenly our songwriting process was like, you know, hijacked, because on Sweet Oblivion we all got together and had been working together, and when Mark was drinking, he wanted to do that. But by the end of those,
how did Josh Homme get involved?
Huh? That was a little bit later, when we were looking for guitarists. Right after we finished Dust.
When you recorded,
right. We finished Dust, and we were looking for a guitar player for the next tour. To have a second guitar player so I could, like, do more solos and stuff without having to... Yeah, so while they were doing the... Mark was doing the Mad Season thing, I was, in Seattle writing songs, and Van was living a little North Seattle. He was doing the same thing, but I was in Seattle, and, like, I'd get up every day, write songs, and Mark would call me at the beginning of the day and say, "What are you doing?" And he'd be... Hopefully, I would say I was writing songs, and he'd get pissed off if I looked at anything else. I'd usually finish a song every day, a new song every day, and take a tape of it to Mark Lanigan. And this was his period when he was just, you know, on heroin and completely detached from anything. And sometimes the next day he'd call me and say, "Oh, that was really good." Or I wouldn't hear from him. That was like most of the time. So I spent like all that time. That was like one of the darkest times of my life, because it was like suddenly like being in the band was like a job.
And it was
like,
on
1994, 1995. Yeah. And we just, you know, we weren't on hiatus. We were just... what happened, we recorded an album in the late 93 with Don Fleming again. And we just didn't like it. You know, the songs weren't there because I hadn't been writing songs, and we hadn't been writing songs together. And we were like, okay, we got to like spend the next however long, we didn't know how long, writing songs until we come up with something good. And
And
take a little break from the burnout from touring, though, too.
Right. So because Mark didn't want to have any, you know, he was more interested in drugs than writing songs, I guess.
Yeah.
Bill had the van of me to write the songs. And I wrote some of the worst songs I've ever written in my life during that period because I just had to, because I had to write a song every damn day. It was like I got hundreds of songs in that period that just are like, and we did come up with finally, you know, a lot of songs, 10 songs or maybe a few more. There were some other ones that should have probably been on the record but didn't make it. But, you know, there was a just, that was a really tough time. And
yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, so finally, after in the middle of it all, we went to Australia and did the big day out. That was fun. I actually had a little bit of fun in the middle of that time. That was like early 95.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but then we got finally, after we had been writing the songs for like about a year and a half, we got hooked up with George Koulias as the producer, which was cool. And decided we were finally going to go into the studio, you know, because, I mean, Van and me were ready to quit the band. We called Mark and tried to quit, and he wouldn't let us quit because we weren't doing anything, you know. It was like, what are we doing? We're not doing anything. We're forced to sit here, and we had to, you know, we didn't have the money to live on. We had to, most of the money we were living on, we were borrowing from our managers. You know, he got hooked up with these really big-time managers like Q Prime, who did, like, Def Leppard.
And, wow.
He was one of the earliest AC/DC managers, like Peter
Martin. Milk the sacred cow while you can, as they say.
Yeah, yeah, right. So they were. I hated the actual managers, but the people there were really cool, and they would actually loan us money to live on, which was nice.
Yeah.
Of them to do. And so I managed to at least be able to get through that time financially and mentally, even though it was like, you know, having to be forced to write songs was not the way I used to do it. I just wrote because I liked doing it, you know. So.
It becomes like clockwork, like desk work, like, you know,
yeah.
For a living.
Yeah. Things looked up, though, by the time we actually got to L.A., George Koulias made us rehearse for, like, 3 weeks. That was, like, new. We hadn't done that before, like, actually, you know, go into, like, pre-production for the record. And he worked with us, like, some of the parts of the song and stuff like that, rearranged things, deciding which ones we were actually going to do, and got in the studio and recorded. We had a good time recording. Lanigan came out of his shell, his dope shell, some during the time. You know, I was just a little bit disappointed on his singing wasn't near. I mean, somehow on Sweet Oblivion, I think he really came over the top in his singing and writing,
absolutely.
And writing too. I mean, he on Sweet Oblivion, at some point we had all the basic tracks done. We were waiting for Mark to do the vocals, you know. Okay, Mark has to do the vocals. And at the same time, since we've been writing stuff together, we had about half the songs didn't have lyrics yet. And he was supposed to write the rest. You know, that was the whole idea. Some of them didn't even have titles yet.
Yeah.
And he disappeared for several days in the drunken haze and then came back massively hungover. And we, like, left the studio for, like, 3 or 4 days and came back. And he'd suddenly written the shit at some point and sang it all. Amazingly, and I was just like, whoa, blown away, still blown away that he did that. Unfortunately, on Dust, you know, he was, I mean, he really, it's weird because, like, the difference between the collaboration on Dust and on Sweet Oblivion is like night and day. I swear, I think Dust was probably one of the collaboration-wise least amounts of collaboration from Lanigan. I mean, he just, you know, I spent all that time writing the songs, and we got him to come over a couple times, but the only thing I can remember that he wrote at all was the beginning of Gospel Plow, that, you know, that pre part on the very beginning of it. And that's like an old gospel song anyway. I didn't even realize that till later.
Yeah, it is.
But everything else was like me and Van. I mean, you know, Van spent a lot of time with me working on stuff like Van. We wrote Gospel Plow together, and Van wrote Witness. And he helped me write a lot of the other songs, too. So, you know, but that was disappointing because after having collaborated so much on Sweet Oblivion, I kind of hoped that would happen again. But somehow we pulled it out. And, you know, Dust is one of my favorite albums we ever did. But I think that was the record. We finally got together the sound we wanted, partially because of George Koulias, who's such a great producer. And the keyboard player, Ben Montench, who's in Tom Petty, the Heartbreakers.
he knew him, and he got him to play a lot of the stuff. So
it definitely has more of a psychedelic feel, if I may say that.
Yeah, I'm sure Mark would probably be.
Oh, fuck you.
No, but yeah, it does.
Take the compliment.
I mean, to me, that record's like what I really wanted to do, you know, like 10 years before, but in like, you know, an actual classic rock sense, you know, that sounds like an album that was made
yeah.
in the 70s or something like that, in the, you know, really, you know, high quality studio with good players.
Record, without doubt.
Yeah.
So then what happened after the tour and the addition of Josh Homme and everything?
Well, that was, you know, I sure Mark writes about in his book a lot. Yeah, I know about him going out to search for dope in like the shitty parts of the city and stuff. When we get to town, like Mark would disappear, like going out to like Skid Row or something looking for dope, which kind of sucked. And, you know, having to loan him money and all that kind of stuff. And so,
yeah.
But everybody else in the band, you know, we were just like, we really want to do this well as we can, and you know, we played really well. I think with Josh it was like that those tours, like, you know, I probably played better than I ever had before because I had Josh, you know, support me on the rhythm
yeah.
stuff, and I was suddenly able to play all these leads and stuff that I never was able to play before, and I think I was playing better than I ever had before.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't jump around quite as much as I had before, because I would be like, you know, you have to jump around, you have to like pressured to do that kind of stuff, but not, you know, I was actually playing. And I had a good time on Lollapalooza, and we did a couple tours, like we opened for Oasis on a few shows. And
the Howling Tree.
Yeah, that was pretty funny at the time. It's funny that they brought that up again after so long. Yeah,
you
I mean,
seriously, like, get back together parts of the band and just sing the songs yourself, since you obviously can do it well enough and call yourselves the Howling Branches.
Yeah, there you go.
Why not?
I don't know. At some point, I don't think I ever made a legal agreement with Mark, but I kind of feel this way too about, you know, the Screaming Trees. It was all of us together, and, you know, especially Mark and me. And without one or the other of us, is really not the Screaming Trees. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel fine, you know, all these years later, I feel fine about, you know, playing the songs and stuff, and, you know, Mark's little parts of some of those, but I'm not going to do like, well, he like Dollar Bill, Van and him wrote that together. I probably would never do that. Or Dooley
yeah.
Paradise, another one Van and wrote together. But, you know, a lot of, you know, I wrote, he does a whole bunch of different over the years. He's done like a lot of Screaming Tree songs that he didn't write hardly any of. So, yeah, whatever. He never done Dollar Bill, oddly, I don't think, that I know of, and that was one that he wrote. So anyway, I just feel like it's not the same without him. Plus, I don't know, like getting back together thing is like, we did think about it about 7 years ago, I think. We were like, maybe we should get back. It was about time we had that last Words record to come out. And we
yeah.
were thinking, you know, maybe we could make a lot of money if we got back together. I don't know. That the thing, first of all, just to get back together and make money isn't really a very good artistic motivation.
No.
I mean, you know, it's too bad. You know, we make a little bit of money now. I mean, you know, on publishing and stuff, enough to at least feel like getting rewarded somehow. You know, not enough to live on, but... Yeah, but we didn't quite sell enough records to, like, you know, sit back and retire on it. But
yeah, rest on your laurels.
Yeah, right. But, you know,
do rock star things like play golf.
Yeah, right. Most of those people spend all their money and have to come back and do something else anyway. And I'd rather move on
yeah.
and do something myself, you know. And now I do stuff that, you know, I love. The only reason I even do music is because I like it. You know, I'm not doing it because I want to sell a bunch of records or something. I don't sell very many, but, you know, it's satisfying just to, you know, go to the post office and send out a record every few days or something, which is pretty neat. And have people, like, you know, I just like, I on my Bandcamp page, I just let people stream whatever they want to. If you're on the website, you can listen to it as many times as you want to on the site. So, you know, I realized after, like, after I released I hadn't done that much except for promotion until about
a year and a half ago when I put out the Unicorn Curry album. And yeah. I decided I was going to do stuff on Facebook and answer people's questions and messages and stuff. Because before that, I was kind of just – I've always been real shy, like a total hermit. You know, it's really painful to talk to people sometimes. It's like people like asking questions on Facebook.
Same type of person, too.
Yeah. But I just decided, you know, I'm going to, like, step out and, you know, do something. And at the same time, I was like, well, you know, I can use the Screaming Trees stuff to promote my own stuff. So that's why, you know, I kind of – decided to do more of that. I didn't realize that we have band started that the Screaming Trees page. It has something like 70,000 followers or something like that. Several years ago, I didn't even realize that until about 4 or 5 months ago. And I started using that too and got a lot more attention from that. So,
absolutely. I mean, you guys, like I said, you guys are considered one of the forefathers of the whole Pacific Northwest mid 80s, early 90s thing. You guys are. You know, interwoven into that history and criminally overlooked, but
no.
And that's the thing is,
you know, in retrospect, that's exactly what I wanted to do. And I did what, you know, you have a, it's not too many people that had a dream and I had it come true. But I wanted to have a band that was like, you know, like the 13th Floor Elevators or something like that, you know, a band that maybe wasn't big, maybe, but that sold a few records and people heard of and that people really, you know, still listen to and look up to as being, you know, something that was really cool. And I did that, you know, I don't know why Lanigan seems to, I mean, he's had the same thing. Plus he has a huge solo career. Is he dissatisfied with the amount of fame he has or something? I don't know. I mean,
nobody would be interested in Mark Lanigan if he wasn't the singer for Screaming Trees.
I know. Well, I think that kind of bugs him maybe because it's like, you know, because he's that shadow of the Screaming Trees has followed him around for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
It always will.
But like, you know, I appreciate how warm and honest and just, you know, open you are and, you know, how, you know, you guys made some really fucking great music together. And for whatever it's worth, it really got me through a lot of dark times.
Oh, that's really cool. That's another thing that's really cool. People tell me that. It's humbling and really cool at the same time. You know, it's like, whoa,
the
fuck weird.
Dealing with the band of men. So your song sounds
like, I didn't completely waste my life in being completely self-absorbed in my music. At least other people have helped them, you know, so that's cool.
Yeah, like, you know, obviously you can't avoid the questions and, you know, I'm mind blown, you know. Sometimes I get mind blown by what I do. The music and immersed myself into it. If I heard a band that was a different style from a different scene, I wanted to see what the scene was all about. So, you know.
Well, you know, I always think that if I had never heard of the Screaming Trees, I would love the Screaming Trees. I would really be into them because they're exactly the kind of music that I really like.
Same here.
You know, and when I do music, that's what I'm trying to do is like do something that I would really like. You know, it's really cool. Other people like it too.
Yeah. But, like, obviously, do you have, like, a solo band, or, like, do you do all that yourself?
I do everything myself. I've always been, like, you know, it's amazing that I ever had a band at all, because I was just the same way I am now as when I was back in Ellensburg. You know, all the friends and the band, like, the band that we had before the Screaming Trees, the cover band and stuff, was all Van's friends. If I hadn't been for Van, I never would have had any, because I was, like, in high school, I was a total hermit. Out of high school, I total hermit. But then Van got a little bit older and started hanging around with people and started, like, thinking about playing music and stuff. Then I got to be friends with his friends, and that was kind of how Mark Lanigan got hooked up with us, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, but I'm still the same way. I doubt I'll ever have a band. You know, one of these days, I've thought about playing, like, solo acoustic shows, and I do that stuff on yesterday, the first time I did a live Facebook thing, which is kind of, I don't know, I just like, I like being in control of, like, sound and the image and everything, and that was kind of scary, but it worked out really good, so I'll probably do it again.
I really enjoyed that. Like I said, I mentioned
it. I know,
that.
I wasn't even, I've been thinking about it, and I just came outside yesterday with my guitar. I was like, maybe I'll try it. Okay.
Yeah.
I think I can remember Winter Song okay, because I'm just horrible at remembering the damn lyrics. I have to, like, read them. Like when I actually did a couple of, I did like three or four solo shows back in the late 90s and did a few Screamin' Tree songs and my own songs. And I had to spend like 2 or 3 months memorizing the lyrics to about 10 songs. I just couldn't remember them. I can remember parts of them, but you know, I don't know how Lanigan remember the lyrics to all the songs.
Yeah.
I had a good memory for that. But yeah, so maybe one of these days I'll get out after this virus garbage goes away.
Yeah, are you working on anything new that you're going to be putting out anytime soon?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of a record. For some reason, the last month or two, I just have got completely not doing anything. But I've got about half that. I got 10 new songs written and vocals and rhythm guitars and stuff. I just got to do a bunch of guitar solos and mix it and stuff. So hopefully, like in a couple months, maybe by the fall, I'll have out. It's called, it's got a title, or it's called Revelations in Fuzz is the title.
Nice.
And it's going to
I'll definitely be on the lookout for that. I get paid weekly. I'm an essential worker through this virus at my day job.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
I will be getting the Microdot Gnome as soon as I possibly can, though.
Cool.
I want a final copy of that.
Yeah, I still got quite a few of those things. Yeah, see, the guy puts it out. That was another thing that happened right after my brother Van put out one of my records, the Ether Trippers. So I can't get him to send me any. He's got more of them, but he's like, I'm going to send them to you. But I sold all of them out. But I still have a few Unicorn Curries and quite a few Microdot Gnome albums. But the guy in Italy I got hooked up with a year and a half ago, I was like thinking like I wanted to get the record out on vinyl, and Van was like having some personal problems and wasn't doing anything. So I tried this place called Digger's Factory where you get pre-orders, and it's from France, and they manufacture the vinyl for you, but I didn't hardly get any pre-orders. And I was like, oh, well, I'll just do it digitally or whatever. But then all of a sudden I got this guy, Vince Bus Erupt and David Pansalon from Italy. He was like, hey, I'd like to put out your record on vinyl. I was like, that's interesting. Just out of nowhere. And he did. He must have it in with the pressing plants, too, because he got it put out in about 3 months after that.
Oh, wow.
And that Microdot Gnome one, he got out in 2 months. He had the idea to do it, like, in the end of October and was out in the middle of December. It's like, Jesus.
Wow.
You must know the guy at the pressing plant really well.
Yeah, do this now. Do it.
Yeah, but probably, hopefully he'll put out the next one. And then what he does, like, he pays me in records. Like, he gives me that 50, he presses 300, give me 50 of them. You know, so I don't have to worry about, a contract really or anything other than I can put that out. So,
nice.
It's like, and then I can, you know, I still can do whatever I want to digitally. I got a different company, Forbidden Place Records, that has put out just CDs. They just put out, just came out. I just got them, the Microdot Gnome CD. Same tracks, but I think it's actually got the longer version of that song, the Confessions of the White Rabbit. It wouldn't fit on the vinyl.
Great too. Well.
Yeah, but on the vinyl, I made an edit of it. So he'll probably, as he's still doing his regular, he'll probably put out my next record on vinyl too, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely made a comeback, and for obvious reasons. When the sound's more expanded, I've noticed that it sounds a little bit fuller and warmer.
I always feel bad because I'm too lazy to listen to vinyl. I have my turntable hooked up, and we have, I lost all my damn records. I have about 50 of my records left. My wife still has a couple thousand records. We got about 1,000 of them in the front room. But I just am too lazy. I just, I got addicted to, listening to music on YouTube, and YouTube just has, man, they have unbelievably obscure stuff on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Never would a million years find it in a record store, which has been, you know, the last. And plus, then last year, I'd been listening to nothing but, 60s, you know, garage rock and psychedelic rock. And I was like, there's got to be something new. And I've listened to a few new things over the years. Like, I like the Black Angels a lot, Van Moss and.
Oh, yeah. There's a
few other things
that came out of Detroit called Shadow Show.
Oh, really? Shadow Show.
Trio, all female, pure psych rock.
Oh, cool. Shadow Show. Okay, I'll remember that. Because that's what I.
You get a message after we're done here. So that way.
Yeah,
you,
cool.
If you'd be
like, I really have like.
Included, actually, too.
Yeah, because, you know, so many artists, like older artists like me say, like, oh, it's all done. There's rock music dead. But that's bullshit. There's a ton of new stuff out there. There's so many bands. I think there's more bands now than there ever were before. And, you know, they're all putting out stuff themselves and doing it themselves, which, because they like to do it, not because they're, like, on a fucking record label and have to make money for them or something, you know. That's the best way to do it. It's like there's almost too many bands because there's so many you can't even, like, makes you dizzy. So I spent last April, I think, I was like, I got to find something new. So I discovered King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, they're really good. And they got so many. And so I was like, that was the first thing I found. And from then on, I just, like, kept trying to find a new thing every day. So all last year, I, like, spent, you know, trying to find new music. And a lot of great stuff. I was able to make, like, a top 10 of the year of stuff I really liked. I like, what other bands I like? The Psychedelic Porn Crumpets. They're another Australian band. They're really good.
Oh, yeah.
Who else? I mean, I post stuff. I haven't been posting quite as much stuff the last couple of months just because I haven't felt like, I mean, I have to actually look for stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like, is this new or is this 20 years old or is it 40 years old or 60 years old? I don't know, but try to, like, you know, put something new on there every day. So,
but yeah, I'll definitely send you that then if you're.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
But yeah, man. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to your fans? And what do you love about music?
What I love about music. Let's see. I don't know. That's a good question. What do I? Why do I? I guess it's a sort of. I always figured that. I don't know why I loved music from the beginning, but then when I came to writing music, it really is about, like, sort of taking your inner landscapes in your head and materializing it, putting it in a solid, you know, even though music's not really solid, but it's way more solid within your head, solid form. And it's just like having, that's what I did when I wrote poetry, you know, wrote down a page. And when I started writing songs, I recorded on, you know, first magnetic tape and now digitally, but it's like, you know, it's being an artist. It's like you're compelled to bring your art that's inside your head into the world. And, you know, having been successful at it really, you know, makes you, you know, especially when you get older, you know, I'm like 57 now, and it makes me feel like I actually was a success at something in my life. And then just the added bonus of people liking it and, you know, being into it and stuff like that. I mean, that's like, you know, something that I didn't think about too much when I was younger, but, you know, it really,
you kind of live
a lot of difference that people want to talk to me about it, you know, like they're doing now. So it's cool. But yeah, but I just, that's the reason I still, you know, I go through a lot of days where I don't even feel like picking up the guitar, but then some days I'm, like, compelled to do it, you know.
So, yeah.
You know, I've gone for, like, months at a time not play guitar, but
you get that.
Not recently, but, you know, over the last 20 years, you know. I spent, like, the time we, between the band quit, about the time I did the Microdot Gnome album, I recorded a few, some things, and some of those are on those demo albums, the two demo albums, the Weeping Willow Treatments, but, I really didn't, you know, I was like kind of lost because, like, you know, I didn't have a band anymore. So I didn't But I kind of, like, over the last few years kind of found, you know, a way to do my solo stuff and get it out there. So.
Oh, yeah. And it's great stuff. Like I said, it's in a different vein from what you did, but it's still similar enough.
Yeah. It's just what I don't have to worry about, like, well, Lanigan like this. You know, it's like, I like it. So. And, you know, and my main love of music is psychedelic music, so I do stuff that's, you know, I don't want to sound like Piper at the Gates of Dawn, but I'm definitely influenced by it, you know, and
it's my favorite.
Hear some of it in there. That's what the Screaming Trees were, at least at my end, was I didn't want to sound like, you know, there are some bands that you hear, and there's, even now, there's a band called, check them out, Electric Looking Glasses, brand new stuff from L.A., and I saw their video and heard the song. I was like, and I wrote, like, these guys got in a time machine in 1967 and came to 2020. And then, I mean, it's just like, you know, but I don't, that's not what I want to do. I want to do something that's, you know, is music that is from now, but that, you know, obviously pulls all those old influences and makes something new out of it. I mean, that's what art's all about, is taking all...
You want to take your influences and drag it into the future.
Yeah, it's a synthesis of all the stuff that came before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and hopefully I can keep doing that for the rest of my days.
Well, I absolutely love it. And like I said, as soon as I'm able, I'll be getting a copy of Microdot Gnome.
Cool.
And probably the rest of your discography over a period of time. Because rock music collectors are like the cool nerds, it seems.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the vinyls definitely help, though. Because it's like this big thing you can actually hold. I mean, that's the thing I really miss. Is like, I mean, you know, the album cover art was almost lost, you know, but, you know, now there's lots of album covers around and big, huge pictures of cool stuff that make, you know. That was the thing that really sucked about the fusion between actual, you know, visual art and music. Was almost gone because it's like you get, you know, these little tiny stamp sized picture is your album cover.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Vinyl, you don't have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't really immerse yourself in something like that.
Yeah, it's hard to sit there and look at the little stamp sized picture as opposed to holding the album cover and looking at it. And, you know, if you want to go that far, if you're the artist, like, you know, put something visual that you want people to think about while they're listening to your music, you know.
Yeah, and that's what I used to do. Like, that's what the vinyl at a young age, you know, just the music itself I would get absorbed in, and then when you add, you know, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Two things go together, so hopefully people will still be listening to vinyl for at least some time down the road.
Well, as you've seen, you know, there's 70,000 Screaming Trees fans who would kill to be in my shoes right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's fun talking to people. And I don't know, it's weird because, like, some people, like, the other day somebody was like, are you actually Gary Lee Conniff from the Screaming Trees? And, you know, I'm just a normal person like everybody else. I just, you know. But, and I can talk to normal people like everybody else. But on the other hand, you know, there are some people... like rock people, rock stars, maybe some people who aren't rock stars who think they're rock stars, but you know, that can't happen with them. But me and my brother have always been that way. It's like we're just totally normal people, and we just happen to have been in a band and make music. So,
yeah.
I'm happy to talk to you about it, you know.
Well, it's funny for me because, like, I'm such a huge fan, so, like, the fanboy in me from, like, years ago is, like, jumping and screaming. But, like,
people
forget that everyone's a person, regardless of who the hell they are.
Yeah, well, I felt that when I met, you know, people when we first met Mike Watt, it was like that, you know, but we got to know him because we did a lot of shows at Firehose. You know, that was, like, the same thing with us. You know, we experienced the same thing, you know, with fanboy thing. When you meet your idols. I mean, I've met a couple of people. Like, I met Arthur Lee from Love one time, but I didn't say much. You know, he was playing in Hoboken at Maxwell's in the 90s. And I met Sky Saxon from the Seeds one time in Seattle. So he lived in Seattle for quite a while. And, you know, that kind of stuff, I always just said, hey, it's just cool to meet him. I try to tell him, like, you're the biggest, you know, influence on me ever. They don't really care. But
yeah. Well, you were a huge influence on me, for what it's worth.
That's cool. That's awesome. I'm glad that I could help.
Yeah, like, I'm one of those people, too, where, like, most journalists will try to make a clickbait headline or...
Yeah, right. That was stupid.
I want to do that when I could just promote music I love rather than about how much I hate something and have to endure listening to something that I already know I hate.
Yeah, no. I feel sorry for, like, actual music critics like that. Like, you know, Everett True, he's, like, the guy who, like, did a lot of early Nirvana. He broke in the Enemy and stuff like that. He's on Facebook. They made him change his name. They wouldn't let him use his name, Everett True. His real name's Jerry Thackeray. But I was, like, he has to, like, you know, his job, I guess he still does music journalism. He's also, like, a professor at a college, but he has to listen to shit to review it. And he probably hates, like, 90% of it, but you have to listen to it anyway. Like, a film critic has to go all these movies and be like, I hate this movie. I don't want to go to the movie. Ruins the music or the movies for you, you know?
Yeah, it ruins the whole purpose of doing what you do.
Being in a band does that too, you know, like for a long time, like I was talking about the band being a job, it becomes like that. Then it's hard to even sit down and listen to music. And I always had times in my life where it was hard for me even to listen to music. Really, like, you know, you have to like come through that and just say, fuck that. I'm, you know, not going to listen to this and think, what could I do different if I was doing this? Or like listen to even your own music and think, you know, what could I have done differently? It's just like, you know, it's got to be. You listen to it as a whole and not think of it as a bunch of little parts or something, you know, that people,
yeah.
Especially people in bands tend to do this. Like the drums are like this or the guitar is like that, or, you know, it's much better just to listen to the synthesis of the whole thing, you know, even when people talk about like, you know, like audiophile stuff of like, you know, this sounds better on vinyl or sounds better on, you know, a certain way. I was like, you know, like there's albums like, for instance, like Easter Everywhere, 13 Foot Elevators album. That album sounds like shit, but I wouldn't change anything on it because it's like it's the way it sounds. It's like the feeling of the sound, and the feeling of the sound is way more important than anything. It doesn't really, you know, it can sound like the worst thing you ever heard, like that you can barely hear it. It's like there's an old song on the Pebbles compilation called Green Fuzz. What is it called? It's by Somebody and Green Fuzz. I can't remember the name of the band, but the Cramps covered it. Anyway, that song sounds like it was recorded, you know, like down the hall from a bathroom, but it's the most amazing sounding thing ever, you know?
Well, yeah, there's an old song, don't know, I forget who sang it originally, but She's My Bitch, the original recording. That one sounds so raw and dirty, but it creates such a spooky vibe. It would.
Right, it's a vibe and a mood and a feeling. Yeah, Greg Sage and the Wipers, he's called it gel. He just talked about that.
And that's a good way to put it. I'll have to add that to my rock journalist lexicon.
Yeah. right, gel.
I don't have Greg one of Sage. Those. I mean, I don't know if you like have seen any of my other stuff, but if I do anything, it's interview with such and such out It's never like such and such talk shit about so and so.
Yeah, right. I know.
You know, it's not my style or my thing.
Mystical.
You know, and you know, I think people get too caught up in some of the hype.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, that's all they got. You know, on the internet, it's like that's the only thing that like makes people click on stuff sometimes is hype. So.
Oh yeah.
Not like it used to be. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, this was very fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Quarter kind of shut off for like a second at certain parts, so I had to redo it. So it'll be uploaded in probably three different parts, and the last part will be real short. But
okay.
Is there anything you'd like to say to all of your fans who would kill to be in my position right now?
Just thanks for listening to my stuff and the Screaming Truth stuff, because it's amazing what people do, and really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate everything that you've done and your legacy in the trees as well. I mean, like
Thank you.
It's like one of the focal points that helped establish that whole scene that changed music forever. And like I said, thank you very much again for killing all the fake poofy hair bands.
Yeah.
And if you're ever playing out anywhere near Rochester or Buffalo, let me know.
Okay, definitely will.
My other half does photography, and I take notes to write the article.
Cool. That's what makes that kind of stuff. Other, if it wasn't for guys like you, those like bands wouldn't have any. You know, it'd be like, well, we're doing stuff, but nobody cares.
Yeah.
People
well,
are out there actually.
We do care. It's just
about.
You know.
Yeah,
I don't
I mean,
no record companies wanted to bite on the final sessions. Because that's a fantastic record.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know. It was a weird time for music because grunge had been big, and then people were looking for the next big thing, and this wasn't a real.
And then you had people like Puddle of Mud who were trying to copy everything you guys did, but they added macho douche shit back to it.
Yeah, exactly.
That I'm like, how can you claim to be a fan of Nirvana? But you're writing this song that's like totally like almost misogynistic in a style that he would have.
Yeah,
played.
I know.
That's like awesome.
Yeah.
You're missing
like,
the point.
It was like fifth generation grunge.
like in the Stone Temple Pilots, like second generation.
Like, if I influenced any of those bands, I don't want that on my record. I did not.
I know. Yeah, that's why I really can't, like, when I listen to new stuff, I just, the like, definite grunge influence just kind of turns me off for some reason, even though I love all the old bands like that. I don't know, but, you know, it makes sense that people would have that influence because it's part of rock history now, but it's just, I don't know, for some reason.
It's, you know, I always would look at it as imitation is the biggest form of flattery.
Yeah.
The other thing, and I think I mentioned this to you, is I'm doing an article right now on the top 20, in my opinion, the best grunge bands.
Yeah.
And I put you guys at the top of the list because you know, I find all of your records flawless, and everybody puts Nirvana or Alice in Chains at the top, too.
Yeah, of course.
And actually,
you got Pad on it?
Huh?
You have Pad on it?
Of course I do.
Yeah, of course you do. See, that, like, if I, like, for me, like, Seattle and grunge, that would be Pad. I mean,
yeah,
they're like,
yeah,
they're the heaviest fucking band ever.
Oh, and yeah.
And they sound just like Seattle, and they sound just like what I would think grunge would sound like, you know. So.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, Grease Box, dude.
Yeah.
Like, do, 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 do.
I know. That groove they did, that was like perfect. You know, da, da, da,
yeah,
da.
And it had that punky aggressiveness, but that groove,
oh, yeah,
like Sabbath and Zeppelin, which pretty much epitomized what the whole scene was doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Lamest terms, but I mean, I'm actually working on it with Johnny Noxious of the band Siddhartha, who's kind of a modern,
yeah,
I guess.
I think I might listen to something by them before.
Like them? Because I actually like them, probably because I like that music. But
yeah, I've listened to so many bands the last year, new bands. I can't remember. I got to go back. It's like, did I like this one? I can't remember.
Yeah. But he's actually hand drawing the grunge family tree, so and for the DIY ethic, we're gonna scan his hand drawn one, but because I like this type of music, and you know, I obviously would support a new band that's playing a style of music I already love. Johnny's just a really good down to earth guy, and his bands, like, you know, I'm not sure, I think he's in the Midwest somewhere, you know. And, like, I just really dug his stuff. It's really raw, and it's really, you know.
Again, I know I posted something by them a few months ago.
Yeah, but he's working on this article with me. So, like, you know, when I was like, huh, well, maybe I could reach out to one of the trees, but Mark's probably too cool to
talk. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't want to talk to him. I wouldn't want to talk to him myself.
Yeah, like, I've listened to a lot of the interviews, and, like, he always says how, like, and we ended up making, like, the worst four records in history. But then he says right after that, but, you know, I don't really believe that, right? It's like, why?
Yeah.
Why?
No. Well, we thought we were doing pretty good at the time. I don't know.
How the hell would I react to that? Like,
I know. It's like, I don't know. I mean, he could have quit at any damn time. It's not like we were making money or anything, you know?
Yeah, he's all like, I was homeless and a drug addict, and I had to leave Seattle to live. It's like, well, you could have done it at any point.
I know.
I mean, why stay in the band if you're homeless and not doing anything and complaining about it?
Yeah, I know. He liked to complain about stuff, apparently. I don't know. Years ago, he would talk shit about people. Like, you know, he'd go, like, we'd be on tour in the van or something, and he'd just go on and on and on about one certain person, like, I don't know, you know, anybody that you think of.
And I'm not trying to kick butt or anything by any means by stating this. It's just what I've heard him on interviews. I get cross-eyed, so I'm like, huh?
Well, you know, the funny thing about him is he could be the meanest fucker you ever imagined, or he could also be the nicest person you ever imagined. I mean, he's, you know. And he had
singer
disease then? Huh? What's
that? He had singer disease?
Yeah, maybe. Actually, I think what he has is a fucking horrible childhood. I mean, it talks about in the book, you know, you can read that stuff. But, you know, I knew about a lot of the stuff that was going on. But, I mean, the affairs and stuff between his parents were, like, infamous all over the town.
What? Oh, wow.
So, like, was the bad kid who came from bad parents at that house on the block kind of thing.
Yeah. I know.
I can relate to that and let it...
Just the stuff.
You have two ways you can go in that, because I went through something similar in my childhood.
Really?
You can let it make you bitter, or you can deal with it.
Yeah, apparently made him pretty bitter. So, I don't know. I mean, both his mom and dad are alcoholics, and he started drinking, I think it was about 12, you know, so.
Oh, wow, yeah. But
yeah,
like,
so if you read the book, you can find out about it. I don't even know all of it.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I am interested in his perspective, but also, like, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know. He's just one that it's really draining to read in a way.
Yeah, it's the problem is he's just negative about so many people. He's negative about himself, too. I didn't even read it. I've heard a lot about it from other people, and I read one or two pages, including one of the pages that had the worst shit you could imagine about me, which is what, and the main thing, you know, we didn't get along a lot, and, you know, he thought I was weird, and I thought he was a fucking total asshole sometimes. But the thing that, you know, that was the thing that hurt me the most was when he talked about how shitty the songs were back then, you know, the early stuff. And I love that stuff, you know, I mean, it's like my babies, you know, my kids. You know, that was what really hurt me. I mean, he could say just about anything else except for that. And that just, like, you know, he could say, like, it wasn't my thing. I really didn't like doing it. It was too psychedelic. It was something. But when he just talks about being shitty, it wasn't, and it's not, and there's plenty of people who will say that they don't think it is, you know, and I don't think it is.
Sending you a copy of Other Worlds to sign. So,
okay.
I mean,
oh, yeah, that's right, cool. Yeah, I'll get it back to you.
Yeah, I had to reorder it, and the poster should be here soon, too.
Okay, cool.
It's an old gig poster from when you guys, or it's probably a reprint, but played with Nirvana and Tad and
The Pine Street Theater. Yeah, there's two different posters up for some reason. That was a cool
show.
I've
got the red one coming.
Yeah, the red one? Yeah, I've seen that one.
Yeah. So I'll send that with it, obviously.
Okay.
Send a money order or something with return postage while I'm there.
Yeah, I remember that show. Kurt was like upside down all around everywhere for the stage, man. He was like all over the place.
So were you close to Nirvana and them as well, just to satisfy those people who would want to know?
Yeah. I mean, Mark was really good friends with Kurt, and we, you know, they were my favorite band. The first time I heard of them, they came to Ellensburg and played in 1988, in April 1988, before anyone had heard of them.
I was like that too at that time.
Yeah, we were just blown away. I thought it was like, and it was like seeing the Who, like, you know, in 1965 or something like that.
Yeah,
it was like, I was like, yeah. They weren't always that great live. And the second time I saw them, I didn't think they were near as good. But then, you know, I got Bleach, and I love that record. And I love Nevermind. I used to go see them whenever I could, and we played with them several times. And, you know, and I was like, you know, we weren't great. I wasn't real good friends with Kurt, but I knew him, and he was like, you know, that was friends from a band. We had a lot more closeness with Chris. You know, he was always fun to hang out with because Kurt was always kind of weird and quiet, you know, but Chris was always like, yeah, come on, you know, like Matt Lucas style partying at the show. So we had a lot of fun with Chris Novoselic over the years.
Personalities worked well on stage, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because, I mean, Kurt was always just like, he's quiet, and then suddenly, and then Chris is saying everything and joking and stuff.
There's rumors that Kurt hated Dave Grohl. Do you know anything about that?
No, you know, I don't really know. I've heard that before, too, but, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. Who knows? I never really noticed anything that I thought of at the time, but, you know, we probably played with them, what, two or three times when Grohl was playing with them. But I haven't really noticed them interacting with each other or anything, so.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've heard Kurt talk about in interviews the different dynamic that he added, praising him and never saying anything bad, but yet people are saying that, like, he almost didn't have Dave Grohl play Unplugged because he was playing too loud or whatever or something.
Too loud.
Kind of like, what?
It was a loud play.
Made a good point that, like, as much as he said that he feared the media and they were attacking him, he never said no comment in an interview ever.
Yeah. Yeah, I never thought about it. I've never seen an interview where he said no comment. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Kurt was always real. He seemed, you know, I think he was a real quiet and introverted person, but then suddenly he's like thrust into the limelight. Yeah, but he was also very genuine and normal person in his upbringing. You know, I mean, he wasn't like never the kind of person that thinks they're a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like he was the opposite. You know.
Yeah.
I always got that impression. So.
Well, some people say he was a walking contradiction, but
yeah.
I was just curious about some ins and outs there. If you just,
yeah,
you know, because some of the rumors and some of the stuff, it's like, well, how the hell do we know that wasn't the truth? But I think the problem has been more between him and Courtney, to be honest.
Yeah, I never really had too much to do with Courtney. The most I ever heard from Courtney was when I used to, after Kurt had died and we were working on Dust, Mark, you know, his hotel room, we talked to her on the phone. And I heard a lot of interaction between him and her on the phone. And it was just like, ugh. I don't know. I never liked her as a person, and I never got to know her hardly at all. But just every time I did, it was kind of like, ugh. Like the biggest memory I have of her, I was in 1992. It was Roskilde Festival, like before the show. Like Kurt and Chris were like getting a gold or platinum record from whatever. What was that? Denmark, and they were like joking about it. But she was running around. And like Nirvana needs ice cream. Blah, 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 blah. I don't know. Like that's all she could. It was like she was like really pregnant too. And I think, and I'm pretty damn sure that from that she so supposedly like I never did drugs when I was pregnant, but I've heard and seen stuff. Maybe think that's just not true. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's something that also the public doesn't really need to know.
Yeah,
you know.
It's just imagine like some person that was like married to somebody you knew and they were just really nasty and every time you saw them they kind of were nasty and they like did heroin and got blood all over your dressing room. Imagine did that one time.
Wow.
Her and Flanagan were in Australia. She was like, Hole had been playing in part of the tour, but she came and went on some of the shows that they weren't playing on. And her and Evan Dando was there. I don't know why he was there. I guess he was just playing in Australia too. But and Lanigan at one of the shows, they just like there was blood and needles all over our dressing room. It was like,
oh wow,
thank you for getting blood and needles all over our dressing room. Yuck.
Appreciate
anyway, so yeah,
it. Yeah, HIV possibly because you never know.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what Kurt and Courtney's relationship was like if they loved each other or whatever.
Yeah.
I just know that I love Nirvana and Courtney was like irritating person that I never really got to know. That always seemed really irritating.
That's not what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. But like it's pretty cool though that you could be aligned with those bands and like I said, those who care to dig beneath the surface.
It's really surrealistic. It was that's like at the time when this all when grunge got exploded. Was like, what the hell? And it still is that way. It's like the surrealistic that somebody, you know, the people you knew are like cultural icons. You know, it's like, really?
You are bonded with them as well.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, God, I don't know. But, you know, you see people in the grocery store with Nirvana shirts, well, all ages, young and old, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, get ready, man, because you're one of the last originals we got left from way back before it was grunge.
Yeah, I know.
Back
well,
in 1995 when you were making the shittiest EP ever produced.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That was so shitty that I love it so much that I'm having you sign for me.
And it got that was what EP got assigned to SST. That was, Ginn loved that thing. That was why we, if it wouldn't have been for that, I don't know if he would have signed it. So he kept going on and on about how much he loved it, you know.
And it's like, really?
Yeah, I know. It's like, yeah, dude. So.
But all right, this was very, very enjoyable, and like,
yeah, it was
probably in the next couple of days.
Okay, yeah, I'll post it on my site when I see it.
You know, keep in touch. I definitely enjoyed this. It's nice to meet you via telephone. You know, I enjoyed it. I hope you did as well.
Yeah, I did.
You know, and I'll send you the link to that band that I mentioned and stuff like that. And
okay, yeah.
When I can get a hold of a copy of that, and I'll let you know when I mail those out.
All right, great. Take it easy. Have a good night.
Oh, yeah. Enjoy your night, too, man.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.